If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. This is the final stream for tonight. It's been a very haphazard night. I'm sorry about that. Nothing that can really be done about it. But now I'm here with Johnny McIver. Johnny, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Hi, my name is Johnny. I am a artist, writer, and nationalist, I guess. I'm really interested in amateur science. And I have a lot of interesting topics that I like to talk about. So,
all right. Well, we'll start with, in order to people get more of an idea of you, we'll start with the history of your political development. How did that begin? What kind of worldview were you given by your parents?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, like, you know, I grew up in a Republican household. I guess when I was like in my teens, like I got into more like libertarianism, and you know, for a while I actually held like progressive views, like very anti-white views, like when I was like, because my mother would she would attend university, and she would come back and she would tell me about all these things that she was learning in school. So back when I was in middle school or whatever, I'd learn all about, the Congo genocide or whatever, and all these things that they didn't really talk about in school. So I thought it was like, this really smart, topic, I guess. But, I started to see it as really depressing and, kind of, contradictory or whatever. So as I got older, I kind of swung back and forth between, conservatism and libertarianism and globalism and all these different ideas that are rattling around in my head. It wasn't until I went to college and, at college, you don't really get to choose who your roommates are. And, I spent a lot of time around, black people. I just got to know them. I grew up in an area that I thought was pretty diverse. But it was kind of biased because it was more, more white presenting immigrants or whatever. I had a very gradual development in the direction of nationalism, and I increasingly, just became disgusted with the hypocrisy and the it wasn't really until the migrant crisis in 2015 that I just totally started to switch, because I was learning about like the rape and all of the all the murders and all the horrible things that were going on in Europe. And I was so, it was just so creepy to see the reactions to it. I mean, it was so, they were always trying to control the conversation and trying to just lie about things that were obviously true. Cause I always thought that, like it wouldn't be a big deal to talk about how some cultures are dysfunctional and maybe they don't, whatever. But that's when I started to realize there was a real problem. And it wasn't until college that, I guess up until that point, I guess I had watched like a Donald Trump speech or whatever, where he talked about how he tries to learn something new every day. And I had made a concerted effort to try and do that because I was a big fan of him. And eventually, when I was in college, I started to realize, you know, the one group of people I've never given a chance to listen to before was the white nationalists. Like, it's this topic that is just this big blind spot, you know, and nobody really knows much about it. So I got into like Richard Spencer. That was the first person I even knew about. So I looked into Richard Spencer. I was like, you know, I don't agree with all of it, but, you know, Richard, I mean, he does make some good points. When he was talking about, you know, how, like, when people say that, you know, a neighborhood's full of thugs, right, you know, you know what they really mean, right? And so it wasn't until I got to, like, Ryan Falk's work, where he really put the pieces together about, like, what I was really thinking and feeling, and he could sort of articulate it in, like, a smart way. And that's when I totally changed my opinion about it. So since then, what I've been trying to do is, I guess, look at this whole conversation and try to find, like, I guess, an experimental direction, like experimental ideas, because I could see, like, when, at least when I got into it back in, like, 2017, 2018, I just saw, like, a lot of, I just saw, like, the community was kind of in a rut. And so I was trying to, you know, open my mind as much as possible. So I was interested in, you know, NRX and deep ecology. And, you know, I even had a brief stint in the Orthodox Church, right, where I thought I was going to be, like, an Orthodox Catholic or whatever. You know, I mean, I even had, like, a phase where I was interested in, like, you know, like, you know, like that whole NASBAL vortex thing, you know, or like the anti-liberals, if you are familiar with those people. They're basically like these hipsters who talk about, like, you know, critical theory and, like, you know.
Not the dirtbag right.
Yeah, like those kinds of, like, you know, that hipster circle or whatever.
Sorry, the dirtbag left, I mean.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, since then, I've just been trying to find new stuff to talk about. And along the way, I came into the work of a guy named Bill Gady. And that for me was when things really started to change. That was when things, I really felt like I was developing something original. Because I think he's one of the most important thinkers alive today. I think that his ideas are so, just so significant to not just our political reality, but also our understanding of reality itself. Not to sound like, you know, some crackpot that, you know, is, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm really interested in materialism. Like, I've always had a very, I guess, atheistic way of looking at things. But Bill Gady really challenged just how mechanistic this universe could possibly be. He's taken things to the extreme, questioning the premise of, you know, action at a distance, you know, which is something that really hasn't been questioned before. You know, nobody's really thought to, you know, consider maybe that there's something connecting you know, the Earth to the Moon, and maybe it's a it's simply a matter of you know, understanding why we can't see or touch the mediators. So this is, just so you know, this conversation is going to go in a very autistic direction. There's a lot of topics, and I haven't done this before, so
that's okay. So one thing he wanted to talk about was autism itself.
Yeah.
So,
I think you guys can tell.
But no, it's okay.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be the only autist that's ever been on Millennial. Well, so what would you like to say about autism? Autism, is, I should say, I'll just introduce that. It is a sort of mysterious subject for a lot of people. we're aware of it. The cliche would be Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman, back in the 80s. But, and then since then, Asperger's as a sort of more mild version of it. Mm-hmm. Well, would you say that autism is just a very pronounced expression of the ordinary male psyche or something else?
Well, there's a growing sentiment among a number of people I can name, like Varg Vikernes, Solar Sorcerer, Leif Ekblad, a number of these people. I think even Edward Dutton has argued that autism is actually it's an atavistic psychology. So it's basically just the way that people used to think prior to, you know, farming, right? So it's basically just an undomesticated temperament. It's an undomesticated way of thinking and, you know, organizing oneself, I guess. So like take the example of like collecting, you know, like collecting, like I've always collected things. Like I've always collected just random things. Like I would collect taxidermy. I would collect, you know, fireworks. I wouldn't even use them. I would just look at them. Like I would collect, what am I collecting now? You know, I've actually really put an end to collecting mostly because, it's very expensive. it's a vice among autistic people, I think, that people kind of take advantage of. So like, you know, in my town, you know, they've got fishing stores, right? And one thing that I've noticed is that over the course of my life, the fishing stores have all gone out of business within a few years, but the fly fishing store in the middle of town has never gone out of business. And that's because it's this system that gets you hooked, right? You know, where you have to collect all these things and got to learn all these stupid, you know, whatever. You know, the kinds of interests that autistic people have today tend to be really nonsensical, you know, like Sonic the Hedgehog or whatever. But in the past, you know, like it would have been something like collecting every type of seaweed or whatever. And so the interesting thing about a collection is that it's like you're taking all of these objects and you're putting them into a gestalt that you can look at every day, and you can see connections between all these objects. And so really the purpose of collecting is that it's a means of systematizing one's environment. And so basically you notice a pattern and then you try to collect all those objects to try and systematize that pattern. And so the guy who collects seaweed eventually realizes that, you know, the seaweed only grows behind the reef, right? It only grows where the water is like really cold, right? Or where there's no sunlight or whatever, you know? And so it's, that's just one example. So collecting, you know, and there's a lot of research on autism. Like you can read Leif Ekblad's work on Artos.net, where he goes into all of the different habits of autistic people and, you know, like sort of the relation that there could be to Neanderthal psychology. You know, so for example, like, you know, like this rigid routine that autistic people need, you know, you think about it, you go, well, in nature, like everything sort of works like a clock, right? Everything is, it moves in sort of a cyclical way. And so routine makes a lot of sense in that kind of environment, right? But civilization is very unpredictable. You know, people move from one place to the next, to the next, to the next. They switch jobs, they advance in their careers, they get money, they lose money, you know. So you kind of, you can't really operate. Routine doesn't work as well in a civilization, okay? You have to be much more flexible. And so like, there's this phenomenon that is called autistic inertia. And the basic idea of it is that autistic people have a really hard time starting and stopping tasks. So like, for example, you know, I drink a lot of water. For some reason, I just have like dry skin. I don't know if that's an autistic thing. But I drink so much water. And I always wake up, I always have to use a bathroom. But it's like, I can't get out of bed. So I sit there for like hours and I can't get out of bed. Or like, you know, I will come home from work, you know, I'll park my car and it's like, I can't get out of my car. You know, it's like you turn the key to get out of your car, like turn the key in your head to get out of your car and it doesn't work. But when I'm like drawing something, you know, when I'm hot in the middle of a project or I'm writing something, I'm really, you know, I'm building something in Minecraft, right? I can't stop. I can't turn the key to go in the other direction. And so what's actually going on there is that in nature, like not every intellectual decision that you make in nature is necessarily adaptive. And so your subconscious will have veto power, right? So say like, you know, a guy walks across a muddy stream every day, right? He could, you know, intellectually come up with the idea of building a bridge, but, you know, building a bridge is exhausting, you know, and like maybe the weather is bad or whatever. And so that guy's subconscious will force him to avoid that task, right? Because it's not necessary. It's not necessary, right? It's not something that's going to, it's not life or death, right? And so that's another example.
I didn't know that you were about to stop speaking.
I'm sorry.
I thought you were in the middle of it there.
That's another autistic thing. My right, friend okay. John Nott is just the same way.
Right. So yeah, building a bridge would obviously be an unknown quantity. It would be annoying. It would be inconvenient. He can just keep doing the predictable thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would be an autistic sort of systematizing, just keep doing this routine, even if it's annoying, even if it's unpleasant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I've forgotten where you were going with that.
Well, I mean, do you want me to keep going?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you've ever had a pet lizard, you know, you might notice something strange when you go to feed the lizard, right? You take a cricket and you drop it in the cage and it's like the lizard sees it. The lizard obviously detects it. Like it's right there. In fact, the cricket can go around and crawl over its back and it just doesn't move. It just sits there. And what's actually going on is that obviously the lizard can go and get that cricket. It's just that it's waiting for the ideal or the most cost-effective circumstances in which to move. So it's the same thing with autism. It's like, you know, like if the cost benefit isn't really like there, then you're not going to finish that paper, right? Or you're going to start reading about Sonic the Hedgehog or whatever. So.
It interests me what you said, that in the past, autistic people would have interests or fixations, obsessions that were more, I don't know, useful.
Yeah.
Whereas today, there's a whole range of just crazy, irrelevant stuff that they can become really obsessed with, like Sonic the Hedgehog. And so this is how you end up with the guy who, you know, is an obsessive collector of memorabilia to do with something that really doesn't matter. It's not consequential. Would you say that our society could do with directing autism better? Because I mean, it seems like there's a lot of useful mental energy and acuity being wasted here.
The way I see it is that autism is something that was papered over a long time ago. And that's actually the reason why you have this divide between high functioning and low functioning. So like, you know, when you have bad genes, like sometimes an atavistic trait can be released, like, you know, like a pseudo tail, for example. Some people grow fur, right? You know, like autism is very recent. And so that's why you have like these people that have like mental retardation, but they're also autistic and they want to talk to you about like the year that Elvis died or something, you know? So I think that civilization heavily, you know, vetoes autism. I just don't really see it as something that, like, I do know Edward Dutton pointed out that autistic people are like, what is it, 110 times more likely to get together, right? You know, and have kids or whatever. But I just don't really think that it's adaptive. I just think that it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Like, you know, if you look at the unemployment rate for people that are diagnosed with autism, it's like 88% or something like that. You know, whereas the Native American unemployment rate's like 11.1%. The Black unemployment rate's like 6.5%. You know, that's crazy. You know, like, and people just don't like you, okay? Like, people just don't. Normies just do not like you. And I try very hard to just not even talk to people. Like, I just don't even talk to people because I just drive them crazy. I remember I had one time, I moved into an apartment and I was being very nice, but I drove the guy so crazy that he ran up and down the stairs screaming. So, you know, like, I don't think that we really fit here, but I do think that this energy can be used for political ends, especially, you know, metapolitics stuff. I try to play to my strengths and try to look for patterns between different disparate subjects. So, you know, I just follow my special interests wherever they take me, and then I try to find connections between these different topics to come up with stuff that's original. So that's sort of my method.
How did you drive this guy so crazy that he ended up, did you say, running up and down the stairs screaming?
Yes. I think I was just leaving messes around. Like, I'd leave something on my table. You know, I'd take my coat off, just leave it on the table. Or I'd disassemble my new e-bike on the front porch. You know, like, and like, what was it? Like, you know, I was trying to, because I was living on my own for the first time. I wanted to save money on transportation, so I bought an $800 e-bike. I used that for like 2 years, my main mode of transport when I was in Pittsburgh. But I disassembled it on the front porch, and he lost it. I mean, it was scary, this guy. I eventually got kicked out of the apartment too, because I accidentally left the stove on, and like this girl had enough of me, I guess, and she threatened the landlord, and, you know, so.
So are these traits that you've learned to get under control, or are you, I mean, is the stove on just now, for example?
No,
or,
not yet.
is it something that you've tried to marshal?
Yeah, I've really had to do a lot of self-criticism. I've had to really, you know, that's actually part of where my interest in psychology comes in, is I'm really trying to figure myself out and, you know, develop a routine that works, you know. You know, and like one of the things I do is I just don't talk to people when I'm at work. I just don't say anything to them at all. So
what, I mean, have you been diagnosed with autism?
Well, I've taken a lot of tests and I'm interested in getting diagnosed. In fact, now I'm in a position where I can, so I'd like to, but, I score very high on, autism tests, including the one on ardos.net, which is like very long and comprehensive. So
yeah, I did a test. It was the 0 to 50, and if you score over 25, you might be autistic. I was actually surprised. I think I only got 18 or 17 or something.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I thought it would be higher than that. But obviously, the higher it is beyond 25, the more likely you are to be autistic.
The AQ. I got on that one, I got 30 out of 50.
Right.
But like, the thing is, my score, every time I take it, it gets a little higher because I slowly notice more and more things. Like, before, I never realized that I needed routines. I just didn't know that. I had no idea. In fact, I didn't even know I was autistic until my friend Hallowed, the musician Hallowed, pointed it out to me because he like works with autistic kids, or he used to, and he came to me and was like, Johnny, I think you might be autistic. And I was like, no, I'm not autistic. Like, you know, and over the years, I've slowly learned more and more just how autistic I am. Like, I'm even starting to consider like stuff like headphones. Like, I realize now I actually really hate like loud noises in crowds and like I really hate it. Like I can't, like when I'm in my room, I can't stand it when somebody is like, even remotely in the same area as me. Like I can't stand it. So that's part of the reason why people think that they don't have autism, or, you know, autism is just coming out of nowhere for the first time. It's like people just didn't recognize it. You know, people didn't know about it.
So for example, if you were to go to a restaurant, would you look for a table at the side of the room rather than one in the center?
Yeah, side of the room.
Like, yeah.
Away from people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I can certainly identify with that. Although if I were in the center, I'd be comfortable enough, but I wouldn't choose it.
Yeah. Like I could do it, you know. And you know, it's funny, I was tested for autism when I was a kid, because they all thought there's something wrong with me. Because they all could see I was autistic. But you know what it was? I didn't like the idea of having autism. I was like, I don't know, 8 years old or whatever. I didn't like that idea of being special. And so I just like kind of bluffed it. You know, I didn't think I had it. No, I don't have any autism. And that was probably a bad idea. I could have avoided so much stress if I had figured it out like earlier, not when I was 20, you know?
Yeah. So what are the strengths of autism? I mean, obviously you're describing quite negatives, but I imagine also that there must be good sides to it. I mean, there must be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so go for that.
Well, autistic people have a much easier time just thinking rationally because, you know, they can't stand inconsistencies. They just can't stand it. Like, you know, like even when I was like a little kid, I always knew there was something wrong with the way people talked about race, because I would, you know, because when I was little, I would read about, you know, Charles Darwin, and I thought that was so fascinating. And I started to realize, you know, like when they talk about scientific racism sounds like it makes much more sense. You know, I always thought that I always put it out of my head, like I was always scared of thinking about that, but I always thought there was something weird about it. You know, and when I finally realized it, it was like very emotional, I guess, or very distressing, you know, like that I'd been lied to my whole life, that what I was seeing right in front of my eyes was accurate, you know.
Yeah. Well, tell me more about strengths. I mean, being objective, I'm guessing, is what you're saying there.
Yeah, and they're also extremely sensitive. So, you know, they notice patterns that are very, very subtle. They're also very, like, I guess you could say, like, more naturally perfectionistic. And, you know, I actually talk a lot about perfectionism. I don't view it as, like, some sort of pathology. It's a very unpopular idea, especially in, you know, the modern West. But, you know, I guess we'll get to that later. But autism allows you to see things other people can't see, frankly. I'm always really amazed by the fact that it's like you try to point things out to normal people, and it's like it goes in one ear and out the other. It's like they can't, they're domesticated. And that's actually another point I wanted to talk about. Autistic people have slightly larger brains, especially in early childhood. One thing that I noticed was that the brains of every single domesticated animal are smaller. So like cat brains are about 25% smaller than they were 10,000 years ago. There's a recent paper about it in, what was it, the Royal Society. So that's an indication of domestication syndrome. Okay. And I don't know. I mean, and it's interesting because among these people that, you know, are coming to this view that autism is atavistic, I have seen some elitism. Like, I have seen some people really start to look down on allistic, normal, allistic people, right? That's what they call it, allism. It's quite interesting, you know.
You were mentioned a link earlier with the Neanderthals. Is there a theory that autism originates from that?
Yeah, that's what Leif that's what Leif Ekblad argues. But, you know, Bill Gatey argues that we never even met Neanderthals. You know, they were just some sort of, you know, like ape man or whatever. He has a whole book about it. So I'm not really going to say whether or not. I really don't know. I think it's a pretty complex topic. But I would say it's definitely like a pre-Neolithic psychology. It's definitely pre-Neolithic. And it probably autism was probably the norm before humans diverged, you know, because I think that autism might have evolved differently among the different races. So like in Japan, for example, I would say that that's autism that kind of like evolved in a weird way to where like the people are very hypersensitive and they have this like rigid routine, but they also have these like civilizing pressures, these very intense civilizing pressures. So it's kind of a weird, it's quite allism or autism. It's like something else entirely.
So if Gady thinks that we didn't even meet the Neanderthals, then how did we get their genes, as somebody in the live chats just asked?
Well, he has a whole argument about that. He does respond to that. I don't really remember off the top of my head. But I would say if you're interested in the topic, the channel is called B. Gady. So it's G-A-E-D-E. So B. Gady. He has a whole series talking about it. And he has like lecture. He has a book too. So.
Okay, I have to confess, I've never heard of him before, so this is quite new to me. So, yeah, you wanted to talk about that, and what was the other thing that we... Ah, yes, materialism and rational science.
Yes, yes. I think
most people already know what materialism is, so what is rational science?
Well, rational science is basically... It's an alternative to the scientific method. Okay, so like the scientific method, you know, it's basically empiricism, right? It's math, it's predictions, replication. Rational science is about explaining a theory rationally so that the other person understands it. And specifically, what he means is it's the ability to make a movie of your theory. So it's not about the truth. It's not about evidence. It's not about proving anything. It's simply making sure that a theory is rational, as he defines it. And a rational theory is one that can be illustrated. So, for example, you know, what causes, you know, two magnets to attract, right? You know, like, or you know, what causes two atoms, you know, to, you know, again, all these are just matters of attraction. Action at a distance, right? You got to be able to illustrate the theory, otherwise you're just doing magic. That's the basic idea of rational science. And he criticizes the establishment in the sense that the establishment uses a fallacy called reification. So basically they're using abstract concepts as if they're physical objects. So for example, there's this idea that like, light is a wave, right? Okay. Well, wave is a verb. Okay. So, you know, only objects can wave rationally. That's the only rational way of talking about it. A verb cannot wave itself, right? So you see the issue there. You know, all these explanations like, you know, time travel, warp time, black holes, you know, one-dimensional figures, the Big Bang, you know, all of this stuff utilizes the fallacy of reification. You know, they're treating concepts as if they're objects that you can like, you know, build a table out of or something. Okay. So that's what rational science is.
Of almost first principles is.
Yeah.
That things have to be in and of themselves understandable rather than relying on further abstractions.
Yeah. So it's basically, you can think of it as like pure materialism. So the average atheist, for example, is not, I would not call that person a materialist. I would call them an idealist because I define idealism and materialism differently. Materialism is simply the rational scientific method. It's simply making a movie of a theory, you know, whereas idealism is, it's basically the idea that like concepts can exist or concepts are, it's basically just reification. It's basically what it means. And,
which is sort of magical thinking in a sense.
And so the average atheist is a materialist, quote unquote. They talk about cause and effect when they want to talk about evolution or genes or how these molecules bump around into each other. But they can't explain pull. Like, pull is the last question that we have to answer in physics, because you know that's the once you understand pull, like the game is kind of over. Like, once you define your key terms and you make explain all of these phenomena rationally with objects, you've basically figured out how the universe works. And this actually gets into the more, I guess you could say, emotional aspect of materialism that is really at the center of the debate, because I know that materialism is a curse word in this community. Materialism is always equated with nihilism and with consumerism and with just anything bad, really. I totally understand it, because I hated the idea of materialism my whole life. I absolutely hated it. And I went through a really bad existential crisis when I was in middle school, when I was starting to realize the implications of atheism and just what a poisonous worldview that is. I don't think it's better exemplified than in John Gardner's Grendel, which is a novel that is definitely worth reading. It really exemplifies how people feel about causality or about, plainly understanding how this world works, you know. And I really just, ultimately, it's a very, from a rational science perspective, nihilism or whatever you want to call it, this kind of philosophical pessimism, it's actually based in a lot of irrational thinking. It's based in a lot of melodramatic language. It's very biased. It's really kind of silly, honestly. I mean, at least in hindsight, back when I was a kid, you know, I was looking for any argument I could find for the existence of God. Like, I wanted it to be 100% real. Like, you know, I just kept whittling it away. And I eventually, you know what it was? I eventually settled on miracles, because, you know, like, maybe I couldn't understand God or idealism or whatever you want to call it, like, rationally. Maybe I couldn't understand it, but maybe like God is like, you know, the foundation of rationality, and he's the architect of that or whatever. And so maybe these miracle events that I see, you know, like somebody predicting someone else's death, or my mother, she actually had a dream about our neighbor dying. You know, she had a dream about dying, and then he died the next morning. So it was stuff like that I really clung to. I couldn't cling to anything else.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I got older that I realized how biased this sort of, materialism is poison kind of worldview is, because it's like you're just constantly imagining, basically, like, you're treating life like it's a Live Leak video. Like, life is not just a Live Leak video. Life also has a lot of nice things happening in it. And so it's actually, you see how that's kind of biased, like where you're imagining death and war and human irrationality and, you know, or like, like a nihilistic person, they will imagine a beautiful woman like deconstructed as like some sort of like headless automaton or something. But, you know, you put the woman back together and it's like she's a pretty woman again. So you see how that's like kind of psychotic? Like you're just imagining things that don't exist. And so, I push back against
deconstructivism. Can actually just be dishonest. It's just a way to actually distort the truth.
Yeah. I'm sorry I keep talking over you.
No, that's fine. You're the interviewee, so don't worry about that. Yeah. if it's going off in a direction that I don't think is helpful, I will intervene. Don't worry about it. Just relax. It's fine. Yeah.
But what was it? So I really push back against this current within our community that says that or at least implies that there's something poisonous about understanding our universe. There's something poisonous about understanding things in a mechanistic way. And what does mechanism mean? Well, you're talking about causality. You're talking about cause and effect. Something is causing the other thing. And, you know, like, look, I can understand wanting to have a culture or religion or whatever. And I understand all those arguments about how religions can be adaptive, you know, which is, for some reason, I don't understand why Christians are making that kind of argument. It seems very shrewd in my opinion. But, you know, like, you know, when we nationalists, okay, we're trapped in a cage. Like, we don't have any power whatsoever. Like, yeah, there's some influencers and whatever. There's Elon Musk and whatever. But we don't really have any realistic solution to winning. And so in that sense, we're trapped in a cage. And when you're trapped in a cage, when you're in dire circumstances, you have to start from the world as it really is. Okay, you have to really understand your predicament as completely as possible. You have to... You don't puff up like a turkey and start making threats. You try to get the key, right? In the way that many orangutans, you know, they escape from zoos, you know, like look into the story of Ken Allen, for example. He escaped from the San Diego Zoo like 8 times or whatever, you know, this because who would think a monkey would escape from, you know, like, you know, we've got all this technology, you know, we're much smarter than the apes. We got them all surrounded. You know, there was an orangutan, I forgot what his name was, Fu Manchu. He hit a wire, I think it was under his chin flap or in his mouth, and he would unlock the cell at night, and he would wander the zoo, and then in the morning he would lock it back up, you know? And, you know, so... Don't underestimate yourself and don't underestimate, you know, I guess, the underdog, I guess. But you got to start from the real material conditions that you're dealing with. That's how you get out of the cage. And that's my main thrust.
And, well, what do you see as our cage, our situation right now? And, I mean, is there any hope?
Oh, I definitely think there's hope. It's a very complicated set of material conditions, obviously. It's, you know, all sorts of institutions and, you know, I don't like the word the cathedral, but, you know, cathedral just means like a bunch of people in offices, basically. That's basically what it means. What I advocate, any good orangutan, I argue that you have to study every day. You have to be very serious about studying. Studying is a form of activism. It's something physical that's going on in the physical world. Okay. From my point of view, ideas aren't concepts. They're actually physical objects. Okay, they are arrangements of atoms or the threads that are swinging between the atoms, and you know, these patterns, they get these objects, they get changed into some sort of medium, like you know, like speech, you know, sound waves, writing, or whatever. And so these that's how we can say that mimetics is rational, because if for ideas to evolve or to influence people or to you know, like if you're going to talk about them like viruses, they have to be objects. Okay, so in that sense, studying and discussion is activism. It's physical. You're changing the objects that are all around the world right now that are listening to this in a physical way.
Right. So how does that enable us to improve our situation, like in the, you know, the dissident right?
Well, I think that the answers to these very difficult problems of power and whatnot, I think that those will be emergent through you know, this dialectic that we have on the right, which is probably the most authentic part of it. And that actually gets into my discussion about LARPing. If you were to look at the most authentic aspect of the dissident right, what's the thing that actually works and does things and, you know, in the way that it's actually described, I would say would be the dialectic that we have, this discussion that evolves over time. You know, if you compare, I mean, you've done 10 years of millennial, right? You'll know that the early discourse is a lot different than the new discourse, right? And I would say, based on my time, I've been in this, I guess, 6 years or whatever, I would say that it's improved significantly. And I'd say that people are a lot more sophisticated than they used to. You know, and compare that to like a lot of IRL activism, which is mostly a series of routines that aren't really adaptive. Whereas this is something that is self-propagating. It works, it functions, you know, and what I argue is that you got to really emphasize that routine because it actually works. It's one of the ones that actually works. And so you lean into your strength, right? And so what I argue for is, I guess, this concept I call the extreme learner. This is basically a person that just spends every waking hour of their life just like thinking about these topics and writing things down and studying and putting them into a very accessible, comprehensible format, which is what I do. I have all these notebooks that I'm filling up every day and like working on problems, like not just like reading about the history of Prussia for its own sake or whatever, like actually trying to find some sort of pattern that you can use, like a lot of the patterns I'm talking about here, right? Like autism or
yeah, I was gonna whatever. Say weaponizing the autism, as it were.
Yeah, weaponizing the autism.
Yeah. I can understand that. I think that it's autism, as I said at the start, most people are not autistic, but but Spergery is a thing. And yes. You know, Asperger's, I think, is far more, it seems far more prevalent than actual autism. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. It's just something that you need to learn to use productively. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are loads of them in the movement. There's no question. But I think it might be. Do you think it's the same on the left?
Like there's autistic people, like, you know, like they've got like lefty pole. Like if you're autistic, you probably go to lefty pole, honestly. I mean, but then again, like Reddit, it is a bit complicated, isn't it? Like, cause you got Redditors that they have like their special way of doing things. And if you even say something that's not political, but like, I don't know, I guess out of routine, it's like they get frustrated and they just downvote you and they just say like, wow, I can't believe you would blah, blah, blah. Or even if it's not political, even if it's not offensive, they get upset about that kind of stuff. But what I will say is that our enemies are not intellectual in any way. I would say that there's very little of any interesting or substantive discussion anywhere. There's no realistic thinking whatsoever. And what I hate is that right-wingers look at these arrogant midwits and they look at the way that they look at the fact that they're winning. They have all this power and they're going, oh, well, that's a secret political strategy that we should use. And so you got all these guys that are acting like, you know, the Giga Chad meme or whatever. And, you know, I just find it a bit frustrating because I think it, from my point of view, that kind of pulls down the discussion. It kind of makes it psychotic in a sense. Psychotic in the sense that you're just like imagining things that don't exist. So.
Well, I think you're right. Obviously, the left has tremendous power behind it. This is the whole thing about them decamping to blue sky. Whenever we interact with them, they lose. And even if they don't lose, let's use myself as an example. I can be having a discussion with some tit leftist on Twitter. And even if I don't win the argument, I know that I should have won it because I know that he's wrong. I know that he's deluded. I heavily suspect that he knows he's wrong and is deluded, but he's come up with the clever argument or the pithy, sarcastic remark or that bit, that thing that would take ages to disprove.
You
know, it's just exhausting for everyone and everyone's lost interest. It's the whole thing about a lie can travel around the world before the truth has got its shoes on. Mm-hmm. That seems to me how the left today proliferate and elongate the lifetime of their ideas, because these various techniques, it's all different techniques of sophistry and just obfuscation. Because reality is fundamentally at odds with them, with all their ideas. It's complete bullshit at this point.
Yeah.
And they can only keep it going by lying, including to themselves, I'm sure.
And, you know, that to me is the great weakness of the left. It's actually not a strength. You know, arrogance is a weakness. Thinking psychotically is a weakness. I know that sometimes it can be adaptive. Like when you think something psychotic, that's not real, but it works in some sort of routine that, you know, passes from one generation to the next. It has some sort of adaptive advantage, breeding advantage or whatever. Okay. Well, most of the time it doesn't. and it doesn't because, you know, our intellect allows us to, I guess you could say, double adapt to our environment. So you don't just adapt to an environment, you know, because of your genetics, but you can also like intellectually change your behavior to adapt to some other environment. Right. And so it's even faster than like epigenetic change, you know, a psychotic person, will often just make the wrong decision, you know, or they'll see something that wasn't there and they'll run into it or whatever. I mean, people will bring up the new atheists and they'll say, well, look at what rationalism happened. It's like, do you really think that these people are rational? Do you really think that these people, make any sense? These people are arrogant. They're stupid. And they piss people off. I mean, look at what happened with new atheism. I mean, is atheism something that you can proudly proclaim on the internet today? No, it's because they were idiots and they annoyed everyone. And, you know, then they got their just desserts.
Yeah. The smugness was through the roof. I mean, I still collect atheist memes now, taking the piss out of them because, I enjoy that they've been defeated. You know, I enjoy being smug about it because they deserved it. So even now, 10 years, 15 years after they've ceased to be a thing, I still collect memes whenever I see one, you know?
Yeah, like the science mystery.
all of that kind of stuff. I could share some now from my folder.
You got a folder?
Yeah, of course. Doesn't everyone have a meme folder? Maybe I collect memes. I do collect various things, but one of them is memes, and I try to have it fairly well organized.
Yeah. I mean, when I was in middle school, that was when New Atheism, or I think I was just starting high school, and the New Atheists were even at my school, and I was dealing with all of these like really awful existential problems, like you know, the feeling like experiencing nihilism is kind of like, it's worse than like wanting to kill yourself. Like that's how bad it is. At least if when you like fully consider that worldview, like, and you had these like smug Redditors, like, you know, like chuckling on the bus or whatever about Richard Dawkins or whatever. And it's just, I hated that. I just found it so annoying and condescending and, you know, and.
This is a guy who he apparently was somewhat self-aware. I've been told. I never actually encountered this guy, but apparently he was somewhat so. Like this is somewhat deliberate humor. But I do love the with knowledge in my artillery. I am quite the opponent.
Yeah,
brilliant. And then this one, of course, is hilarious, but also ugly.
Yeah, yeah.
Very unpleasant, really. But there are so many of them. I think everyone's probably seen this kind of stuff before. But of course, this one is just brutal, really. Very unfortunate.
Right. Yeah, guys, remember this when you're talking about how, like, I don't know, what is it? Like primordial truth or whatever, like Faustian, like this is going to be you. Okay.
Yeah.
This is going to be you. So don't do that.
Yeah. Ugly. Very bad. But then you get this kind of stuff. This is one I like. This is, I think, George Carlin.
George Carlin.
I mean, he really, I just despise him.
I mean, he had some interesting takes. I think people are actually, no, I think people are pretty accurate about him. He was a really gross person, you know.
I would say so. And the thing is, the funny thing is, maybe you can observe this yourself. I don't know, but I've been around long enough to remember when this stuff seemed cool, even to me.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Until I was about 22, this stuff. Maybe a bit later, 24. This stuff would have seemed cool and funny and clever.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, due to circumstances in my own life, I suddenly realized this is just awful. It's just fucking stupid. And then about 5-10 years later, the world agreed with me. And these people just fell away. I mean, they're not on YouTube, really. They are still, but it's not like a, you know, an ecosystem like it was, where there are different channels reinforcing each other. It's very much isolated things now. And thank God. But the thing is that, you know, at least you can say the alt-right got deplatformed. The new atheist thing just sort of burnt itself out.
Cause it was And it's not
the purpose.
I actually want to emphasize, in Rational Science, the question of atheism is actually pretty weird, because we don't consider atheism to be scientific. We don't think that atheism has any place in science because it concerns belief. And when you're talking about the existence of God, okay, well, you got to define what the word exist means. Like, what are you talking about? Like, what do you mean by God? Are you talking about some sort of physical object, some guy out there? Or are you talking about a concept like love or intelligence or, you know, knowledge, you know, running, whatever? And so we would argue that exist means physical presence. So it means, you know, you got an object that has location, you know. So this object right here, there's a distance between it and me. And that's what we're actually experiencing when we say exist. Okay. Whereas like Bugs Bunny is an object that doesn't have location, right? Bugs Bunny isn't in the room with me. Right. And so it's an object that doesn't exist. So in order for a word or some sort of term to exist, it's got to be an object that has location. So The idea of God's existence actually isn't crazy because there's at least five people in the U.S. named God. You know, I mean, you could name your goldfish God. You could, some wrestlers call themselves God, you know. So that's why I don't say I'm an atheist. I say I'm a materialist. Science is supposed to be objective, meaning it doesn't have anything to do with whether you believe or don't believe in something called God. It's just about, you know, whether the theory is rational. And I just don't think that, you know, religious people even know what they're talking about. I think that they will always imagine something that kind of feels rational. And this is a phenomenon that I call error of completion, but that's a bit of a complicated topic. You know, like, if you're going to tell me God exists, just tell us what exist means, you know, and you got to defend that definition. You know, I know Thomas Aquinas says that, existence is the actuality of an essence. And you go, okay, well, what is an essence? So he's playing around with synonyms, right? You know, and all of these philosophers, they always end up, or even just look in the dictionary, right? The definitions always lead back to synonyms. And so you're kind of like laundering this term that we've intuited through a bunch of synonyms to pretend like you understand it. So that's how we answer the God question. There's no God. Or the question of God's existence is complicated.
It certainly is. All right. Let me ask you that there was a somebody in the chat, someone said, you know, exactly, where is the location of God? All right. So let me see. I thought there was something that was going to pick up on. Someone said that George Carlin would have been completely woke if he'd lived. I think he died in 2008.
Yeah, he probably would have.
Yeah, I think he would have. More interesting is Christopher Hitchens. But I'm guessing that he would just have become a counter jihad.
That guy.
Still going on about Israel and Zionism and how wonderful that is. But I think he would have just done what he did at the time. And he would have been anti-trans.
Like Richard Dawkins.
Yeah, like Jordan Peterson. I think he'd have been exactly... In fact, maybe Jordan Peterson was kind of located and elevated because of the absence of Christopher Hitchens. Maybe if they'd had him, they wouldn't have needed Peterson.
I see.
I don't know. It's just that's just occurred to me right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so to move on then to reinventing the arts, and you also said
yes.
That's obviously a huge
yes. Thing. This is why rational science is important. Because if you use the RSM, rational scientific method, you can figure out if what you're talking about is rational or not, and you can also use it to basically explain any question that you have about reality. So I've been applying it to psychology because Gady has no interest in psychology. He says it's boring, complicated. He doesn't want to talk about it. But he established the very basics of psychology. You know, how, like, what consciousness is, for example. Consciousness is just a verb. You know, and that's actually the reason why, like, if you listen to like the streams that Ryan Falk has been on lately, you know, he points out, he says, like, you know, when you turn on the robot, or you turn on the AI, it's like the robot's conscious. You turn off the robot, robot's unconscious, you know. And so he doesn't really seem to get it, that's what consciousness means. Consciousness is a verb. Consciousness is not a thing. It's not something that you can draw. It's the process of sensing, right? And so like take light, for example. In the Gadian view, light is just the torsion of a rope between two atoms. Okay. And so color is like the link length, you know, the length of the links in the rope, right? It's not a frequency, you know. And so the reason why we can't see the rope is because the rope is that which mediates see. Like, if light is the torsion of a rope, how are you going to see the rope, right? You see why we can't see them now, right? And so it's the same with consciousness. Consciousness is just like, you know, it's just these, it's just a verb. And then like we get confused because we're the ones doing the consciousness. And so we ask questions like, okay, well, why am I conscious? It's like, well, because of the material conditions that allow you to be, because of the, it's a type of motion that's found in our head. It's not found in rocks. It's a very special kind of motion. It's a, you know, like light is a type of motion that's found between atoms. It's not found in the threads themselves, right? And so like, so he established the very basics of psychology, and the consciousness is the big one that everybody wants to know. But it's actually kind of a minor issue within psychology, really. But what I've been using it for is trying to understand the arts, because I'm an artist. And my whole life, I've wanted to understand the arts. And I've always been looking for something like rational science. My whole life, I've been trying to find a way of getting at something I could sink my teeth into, you know, because I always found art instruction to be very frustrating, because you couldn't really they could teach you like a technique, right? They could teach you, for example, in Pixar, they teach you to draw with more wedge shapes and less ovular shapes, because I can draw a picture actually. Let me get a pen. Hold on one sec.
It's all right. I'll use this moment to say that this probably tomorrow is the last day that you can post a card if you want it to appear in the Christmas card stream. But you can still post it anyway. Yeah. If it won't be in the stream, but there we go. And also there is the merchandise, which I did spend some time making. I would appreciate it if people bought a t-shirt or a mug. There's also a flag available, and dog tags as well, which is new this year, and the flag. So that's something exciting, a way to remember Millennial X forevermore. Unfortunately, the commercial hasn't lasted long enough, so I'll keep going. There is the NFT, which you can bid on. And what else? If you're enjoying Millennial, you can support it with donations. I take crypto, and there are also various ways that you can donate fiat currency. Ko-fi, buy me a coffee. I got banned from that. I can't remember. Subscribestar, obviously. Entropy works for that as well. And you can subscribe to my Substack, which I would really like you to do, because I'm trying to expand that. All right, here we go.
Excellent. All right, so in Pixar, they teach you to don't draw like these ovular shapes when you're making an illustration, because your eye just sort of moves around aimlessly. They want you to move your eye in a specific direction, right?
Right.
And so if you look at all the great illustration, you see that all of the shapes have intention to them, that your eye moves in a specific direction. Like, you can learn that. An art instructor can teach you that, but he can't tell you why that is. He can't explain, like, why does that work in the illustration? Like, how does that affect me, and in what way? And so I was always confused by stuff like that. You know, they teach you, go darker in your darks, or go lighter in your lights, or whatever it was, you know. And so they can't really get you to understand how this stuff really works. They can get you to understand really basic things, like be organized when you're making an artwork, right? Keep everything in the files, right? Like, you can understand simple things like that, but you can't understand, like, you know, in the case of fiction, you can't understand like free and direct style. It's more like you just sort of use it, and it's some sort of technique that was developed through a process of trial and error, right? And so when you get right down to it, all of the art instruction really boils down to rote learning, for the most part. At least, there are some people that try. There are some people that really try. And there's some people that have wisdom that they've accumulated over the years.
but you're never going to really understand these things. You're not really going to be able to understand like why, I don't know, like the rule of thirds works in photography. Like,
yeah, the golden ratio or something like that.
Yeah, like we'll never understand that. But, you know, with rational science, we can finally start to talk about this rationally. And to do that, you got to really start with psychology. You got to understand how the brain actually works, you know, how we experience this universe, right? And so I actually made a development within rational science, which is this idea that I call the empathetic versus antisocial distinction. So consciousness, thinking, whatever you want to call it, it's just a bunch of atoms moving around, you know, and there's a bunch of threads moving between the atoms. You can think of thought like thought or memories like scratching a needle into a vinyl record. It's something that physically gets encoded, right? You know, like, and then when you decode it, you get the song, right? Bill Gatey didn't want to engage with psychology because the objects that we're talking about are so complicated and we can't even see or touch them. So, you know, in rational science, we only infer. So like we can't see or touch the mediators of light, for example. We can't do that. Okay. So we can only infer it. And we just have to make sure the theory is rational. Well, the objects we're talking about up here are so complicated, it's not even worth it, at least from his point of view. But I found a way to greatly simplify it, and that's this distinction that I call the antisocial versus empathetic. So we have the encoded atoms, right? That's the antisocial view. And then we can assume what they would look like in their decoded state. Because in rational science, you're allowed to freely assume things. So you're allowed to freely assume, for example, that, you know, like that the person was thinking about a cat, for example, just as a simple example, that the atoms encoded for a picture of a cat, right, or an audio file of a cat meowing or whatever. And so if you assume the decoded inputs or the decoded media, whatever you want to call it, if you assume the decoded media, it actually makes psychology a lot easier. And so you can start to realize, like, for example, like why insults are hurtful. And the reason why it's hurtful is because like it allows you to quote unquote fill in the blanks, because insults are very vague statements, right? And so they get you to generate images of, like, you know, like basically things that have to do with your own insecurities, you know, or, you know, like in the case of like art, for example, like, you know, people want to know what art is. Art is anything that stimulates this, this filling in the blanks process. So, like when you look at Dali's clocks, for example, you're not just looking at the objects that are in the scene. You're also generating images of objects to complete that scene or to make sense of it. And so you're imagining, I don't know, like glass fortresses and, you know, gnomes or whatever, or time, you know, melting sunsets, you know. And that's sort of how art works. It's just it utilizes ambiguous content to get you to enter states of you know, completing or resolving those ambiguities, right? And so, you know, when I started applying rational science to the arts, I started with literature, because, you know, visual art is cool and all, but, you know, the stuff that really moves people is fiction. So I wanted to learn fiction because I didn't know anything about writing, okay? And I started a notebook that I now call Johnny's Creative Writing. And I was able to define words like story. I was able to figure out, like, you know, like the secret sauce to, quote unquote, breathing life into a story. Because if you, from a Gatean point of view, life is just unpredictable motion. you know? And so, you know, for example, if you want to write a very vivid picture of like a ghetto, for example, like you want it to really be, to have some sort of life to it, this feeling that we call life, you know, you wouldn't just write about like, you know, abandoned buildings or things that we've already seen before. You might have like a, you know, like a garter snake crosses the road, something that could be in there, but you just don't really expect it. Right. Just as a simple example. And so do you see how like figuring out that pattern that would have taken you years to figure out, but because you've thought rationally, now you can write vividly about anything, right? You can breathe life by essentially implementing what is a synonym of what is it? What is that word? A spontaneity. It's a synonym of spontaneity, right? Or you know, like, and that's how you make dialogue come to life, for example. Like you have a lot of you know, unexpected gestures. Like, especially like, physical gestures. That's how you convey emotion and dialogue. This is something that John Gardner pointed out. You convey it through kinesics and stuff like that. But the key to making it, you know, vivid, right, is, unexpected events, right? So you have like, you know, like say that there are two police officers talking to each other. You know, maybe the man like folds, you know, throws a cigar out the window and folds his hands, right? That imbues the narrative with life, right?
Yes, yes. Now, that's something that doesn't need to be there. It's gratuitous. It's extra. But it makes the.
I mean, look at the Trovints of Romania. The what is it? The living stones. They're basically these stones in Romania that have a life cycle where they grow and, you know, reproduce and like, you know, die and whatnot. And they do it very slowly. Like they're these rocks that move very, very slowly. But they move in an unexpected way. They move in a way that's very difficult to track. And so we call that pattern or that sense, life. That's what we call it. It's just some sort of adjective or verb or something.
I've never heard of those before. I'm just looking at photos of them. That's rather freaky.
Yeah. And there's also these like sailing rocks in, what is it? The Mojave Desert. And they're these rocks that just like scuttle along and, you know, like, We look at that as like living because of how, you know, unpredictable it moves, right?
Fucking hell. I've never heard of this. That's really quite scary. All right. So to bring this back to the matter of reinventing art, is there anything else you'd want to say about that?
Yeah, well, I'm basically challenging this idea that like practice is like the best or like, you know, it's like the only way you can really do it. Like if you want to practice, if you want to become a great artist, you got to be like Kim Jong-ji and you got to draw every single waking moment of your life coupled with instruction. Like, I think that there's another way. I think that you can understand art from first principles in a rational manner and you can instantly master these techniques. I think that, in fact, I argue that, theoretically, you could eliminate around 95% of required practice. So, for example, I don't understand music yet. I still don't understand like why certain notes sound good together or like why do chords work or, you know, what makes a song catchy, right? Although I do have a working theory that has to do with oddly satisfying videos. I figured out how oddly satisfying videos work. When you understand, like art from first principles, like the patterns that would have taken years to acquire, you instantly understand them and can use them. And not only that, but you can use them much more flexibly because, like take Kim Jung-ji, for example. He's a Korean artist. And if you want to know how good this guy is, watch a video of him working. He takes a marker. He doesn't draw any construction lines. And he just draws in perfect perspective. He's this giant scene with tractors and women and, you know, engine blocks. He's memorized entire machines from every part, you know. But there was an interview where, you know, this student, I guess, or whatever, asked him to draw an anime character. And it's like he goes to draw it. It doesn't come out well because he hasn't practiced it, you know. And so practice does not necessarily equate to like, do you see how practice is a bit inflexible? You know what I'm saying? So when you understand a technique, you can implement it on a far wider variety of subject matter and in much more unexpected ways. You know, like for the first time, I really feel confident in my writing. I feel like I can actually like make something really good. It just I need more time to do research. There's some things I need to figure out. So it's an ongoing project.
That's always important. Research is the fuel, the food, as much as your own imagination. What kind of stuff do you write?
I write surreal fiction, you know. You know, I don't really have any like big things published. I have very short things published. Like you can look on my blog, you know, I've got like very short pieces. I got poetry and stuff like that. This project is very autobiographical. Because I've always had a horrible time with ADHD and with, you know, just like maintaining a routine that allows me to write well. I've had to spend hundreds of hours figuring out a routine to actually allow myself to write. So this coupled with my perfectionistic views about art, which we can talk about next. You know, like that's sort of the context of this obsessive thinking that led me here. So because I'm really driven. Like I do not take days off. I never take days off. I'm even writing at work when people aren't looking. But I had to like figure out how to solve ADHD because I just couldn't do it. Like it was like. My subconscious or my brain had veto power over all of my decisions. And so I really had to struggle to get to the page and get things done and stay there, you know? And I think I figured out ADHD basically. I don't really have issues with it anymore. Like I feel in control of my body now because I basically figured out that the subconscious runs on care. So like you don't have ADHD when your mom comes in to scream at you because you didn't do your homework, like you just don't. So, you have to use like, you basically have to like force it through, mindfulness and like, I know mindfulness is a buzzword. I mean, believe me, psychology is full of buzzwords. It's stupid. I get it. But you know, you focus intently, you use your conscious, which is an object in one part of the brain, the subconscious is another object, and you focus very intently on the thing that you have to do, and you just think painful feelings, and suddenly you'll get up. And so that's why I don't really have autistic inertia anymore, because whenever I have to go to the bathroom or whatever, like I just focus really hard on it. I just think very hard about it, and then suddenly my subconscious, without even me consciously thinking, will just get up, you know. And you know, and so that's, I apologize. I got a little off track.
It's okay. So, you do this writing and do you think that it's, I mean, how much does it concern you that other people should be able to appreciate what you do? Or is it something for yourself?
Well, I think it's a little of both. I mean, I do want to impress people. Like I really do want to, write stuff that's like really good that like when I read it, I go, yeah, this is going to be excellent, because my views about art are perfectionistic, which is very a bit unusual because we often treat perfectionism like some sort of pathology or some sort of psychosis. In fact, I actually argue that it's a better alternative to traditionalism. So this actually got me thinking about politics too. Basically, like, perfect is not like some sort of like platonic form or like unobtainable thing. Like, the fact that we even use this word means that we saw something that we called perfect. So we gotta define what we're talking about. And I define the word perfect as that one is satisfied with no objections. So that's all it means. It means that, you know, you feel really, really good about this thing and you don't have any problems with it. And so creating something that meets that criteria is difficult. And most people think it's kind of a waste of time. But the thing is, like, this is just sort of a modern consumeristic way of looking at things, at least I think. Because if you look at other cultures, especially cultures that have, you know, maintained their traditions, like Japan, for example, I don't want to be an idiot. I know Japan and the robot waitresses and all that. But out of all the countries, you gotta admit, they've found a way to make traditions a part of their life even still. That's because they're
I mean, I've never been there, but yes, I've heard that they've integrated tradition and progress, or let's just say modernity, pretty well. They've got a few pathologies, social pathologies, like the incel guys, but whatever. They seem to be doing okay.
Yeah, and they're a perfectionistic culture. They're probably the only culture in the world that thinks about things in that way. And that's actually part of the reason why they work such long hours. It's not like they're just slaving away. They're very slow. And this is something that I've heard about. They're actually very slow workers, and they do things very, very carefully. You know, when you create something that's perfect, it's so powerful. I mean, just try writing a perfect sentence, for example. Just write a poem that, you know, through a lengthy process of revision and intellect, is just excellent. It's just perfect. And those are ideas that's a mindset that I got from John Gardner, the American novelist, because although I think I remember hearing him say that he wasn't in favor of perfectionism, but he basically was a perfectionist. He spent, you know, 10 years on a novel, like writing from sunup to sundown. This guy never took a break. You know, I mean, this guy was really intense. And he even wrote a book about, you know, I guess his elitism about art. I'm not an elitist. I don't have that same view, but, you know,
I've heard an interview with him. I don't know how, but in what connection, but somehow I ended up on YouTube, and it must have been recommended after whatever I was watching. And I ended up watching this or listening to this interview with him. I think it was from shortly before he died.
Yeah.
1980 or something. And I remember him talking about this. That he didn't really think art it needs to be accessible to everyone. He was perfectly okay with an aristocratic culture that a lot of people would be alienated by. Because he thought that was the only way to do it. Otherwise, you're just distorting things.
Yeah. I think that guy was autistic. Any Gardner fans in the audience, I think that guy was probably autistic because he thought about fiction in a very utilitarian sort of way, even though he would never argue that he was a materialist or anything like that. I mean, he thought that was poison. But he was trying to get at, like, what made art great. And that was so captivating to me that you would even think about something so mysterious like that to try and make the mysterious plain, you know. And that's he was the first influence on me. He was the first major influence on me. This is back in high school, like when I started like getting into this idea of perfectionism and art. And like, you know, I would draw every single day and I draw all over my homework or whatever, but you know, what was it like? where I differed from Gardner was that he was an elitist. So he would go up to like other artists, like other mainstream writers in person, and he would call their work trash. And he wrote a book. He called it On Moral Fiction. And he actually that actually destroyed his career, you know, because he was just, you know, he was just he just didn't belong in that whole space. And he just had no social skills or whatever. But that his main thrust that you could be more than just a good artist, you could be a great artist that people remember and that talks about, you know, intellectual subjects, that resonated with me very deeply. And that's what I've been trying to figure out. And so when I got to Rational Science, it was kind of like, you know, bread and butter, you know, it went together so well. And so what I'm going to do after the creative writing book is I'm going to do a book on drawing. I've already got some notes in there. And then maybe when I'm older, maybe do music, but I don't care about music. I used to make music, like sample collage music, like vaporwave stuff, but no.
Not really where your heart is.
No. I created a subgenre of vaporwave. It's called Metro Song. I don't want to spend any time on it, but if you're interested in like dystopian, like corporate, like Verizon commercial music, like check that out. There's a bunch of albums and stuff.
All right. Somebody's asking, are you vaccinated?
I'm not vaccinated. Oh, actually, yeah. Not with the COVID. I avoided that. But, you know, I've been vaccinated and I don't know if that causes autism. Maybe that causes some sort of like epigenetic change. I don't know. I mean, let's just be honest. I don't know very much about genetics and stuff like that. I'm not an HBD guy.
Yeah, yeah. I think the question was about the COVID vaccine. But, yeah, I mean, the normal... Well, this was in the previous stream with Robin Riley. She was talking about all the vaccinations that a child gets nowadays, and it is frightening because
we
don't know what the long-term effects of all these are. Well, anyway... okay, so there was one super chat. Someone said, thank you for putting that magazine cover up on Twitter. You're the man. I've been a fan since I stumbled across a link to one of your videos on Poll back in late 2015. As always, this year's Millennial has been fantastic. Well, thank you very much. And it's nice. It's always nice when I hear that someone has been watching me for a long time, like 2015, 2014, 16. That's a long time, you know, that's a lot of my life. That's a big slice of my life. So, it's rather strange, really rather daunting to think that, somebody would know of me for that length of time and be interested in my work for that length of time. So thank you very much. Of course, this is the 10th millennial. So
yeah,
that's relevant to that as well. Okay, and then BMC says, thank you for another great stream. Merry Christmas, Woz and Johnny. Well, thank you very much. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap up?
No, I don't think there's anything else. I'll just say that if you are interested in writing and you want a different perspective on it, check out my my book on creative writing. And also, my friend wrote a very interesting collection of fiction. His name is Nathan Young. It's a book called Beast Stories. So that's Beast Stories by Nathan Young. It's a really interesting. This guy is a really talented writer. When he posted something on the literature board, and I was just so taken back by it. I had to contact him, but you check that guy out.
Okay, somebody's asking whether I still have the original robe. Yeah, I do. It's up in Scotland. Yes, I do still have it. The one with the hood. It was really cool. It was really good in the winter, actually. Alt White says, "Happy Christmas, Woz. Thank you very much, and Merry Christmas to you too." Okay, I guess that's it. Let me see if there are any There was a super chat. Okay, Black Pigeon Pilled said, I looked up the stats and was shocked. Between 76 and 90% of autistic people were unemployed in Europe in 2014 and approximately 85% in America in 2023. As someone formerly diagnosed as a kid, what does MacIver make of all this? Is it truly a superpower to be a Sperg, or something created by Leo Kanner to stultify us?
Yeah. I don't know what causes it. I mean, I just explained to you what causes it, didn't I? But I think that people kind of just don't like autistic people, honestly. like I think that's an example of like real discrimination, because like, I mean, let's just be honest, like when you know us in real life, we are kind of annoying. Like we do things that frustrate people. The way that we move around, the routines that make us who we are, they get in the way of their routines, and it's frustrating. I mean, I had a manager tell me that, like, Johnny, did you know that you're annoying? So, you know, just got to keep a good spirit, and you got to keep trying. You can't give up. You can never give up. That's a big thing.
Don't give up until the person is running up and down the stairs screaming.
Yes, then you can give up.
All right, then. Okay, well, this has certainly been an interesting conversation, and I think a lot of people have enjoyed it. There have been various comments from, I think you know, Giant Geo.
Yeah, Giant Geo.
Yeah, yeah.
That guy's cool.
Yeah, yeah, he's cool. He's on Millennial a few years ago, and I believe he's going to be in the American Hangout on just after Christmas. So we'll hear from him. But yes, he's quite a character. And there are several other people as well. Apollonian Germ dropped in as well and said some nice things. So yeah, okay, well, this has been a good one. So I'll end it there. I actually haven't eaten for...
I'm sorry.
8 or 9 hours. So I'm in.
You haven't eaten in 9 hours? Oh.
Yeah. But I didn't. And well, the thing is, that means all day, because I'd only just woken up. So
this was a
really messed up day today.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's not your fault. It's, you were inconvenienced by it as well. So I will apologize again for that. Okay. Tomorrow. How many more nights? We've got three more nights. And tomorrow it's going to be, well, three more nights of the regular interviews, I mean. So tomorrow it will be The Jolly Heretic, then Garode Murphy, and then Ava, and then The Distributist. So that should be pretty good. I think there are two... definitely, probably one's definite autist there, and another who's autist curious, and then one that I don't think is autistic, and the other one is an unknown quantity. So there we go. All right, well, I will see everyone then. Hope you've enjoyed tonight. I'm amazed by how shambolic tonight has been. It's usually not like this, but I'm sorry for that, but it seems to have turned out okay in the end. So, Johnny, is there anything you'd like to say? I feel like this is a bit abrupt that I'm ending it like this. I feel like I'm being insensitive to you.
No, you're not being insensitive. If you like spurging like this, I've got a whole blog you could check out where I talk about why, I don't know, like technological progress is over, why homosexuality doesn't exist. So you can check that out, and follow my YouTube channel and whatever. So thank you.
All right. Oh, they're all linked underneath the video. So, I hope people go and have a look.
Oh yeah. And thank you for bringing me on. This was a wonderful stream, and, it was very professional, and, you know, you're doing a great job. So thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I appreciate that. There are these different challenges, but you just got to do what you can. Mm-hmm. So, all right. I will be back tomorrow night, and I hope everyone's there for that. In the meantime, Johnny McIver, thank you for appearing on Millennial X. All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.